All right, good morning. If you could have a seat, we'll go ahead and start in a minute. So as we pick up, I'm going to show you a brief video, but just to remind you where we are, we've hopefully made the point that the six-day creation framework in Genesis 1 is not there to give us science. It's not there to give us a chronology, nor is it to give us a cosmology. The Lord was using language that they could see and understand. He was not giving us a scientific cosmology of the world or the details of how it was made. What we've seen is there's themes, theological themes going on, and Moses has put together a framework showing the themes, especially as the second 3 days match the first 3 days. So I've been telling you that it's thematic, but I've also used the term polemical. So that's what we're going to look at this morning, that what Genesis 1 is also polemics. And if you're not familiar with that term, this is just a Webster definition of polemics. An aggressive attack on or refutation of the opinions or principles of another. So when you're reading something and you say that was very polemical, that means it really went at somebody else's view. It tried to either ridicule or at least confront the other view. Polemical. Polemics can be bad or good depending on the context and with whether they're expected or not. And so, what is the polemic of Genesis 1? Well, you have to understand the other creation accounts that were already around, because Genesis 1 is not the first creation account. The other nations had their own creation accounts. And if you compare what was already available, what the Jews, the Hebrews, would have already been familiar with, then you compare it to Genesis 1, you can see what Moses is doing polemically. But I want to give you just an example. Instead of writing it out, I thought I would just show you in a video. This is a polemic account, or a creation account, the Atrahasis, which is from Samaria. This is a couple hundred years before Moses. This is something that would have been familiar. So this is how their creation account went. I'll only show a little of it. Now, what do you already note in the first? This is what they've been able to take from tablets that were found. What do you note there? Anything interesting that reminds you of Genesis 1? Sevenfold. That even they, the pagans, had this view of seven as a symbolic number for fullness. Where they got that, we're not sure. Is it just something that naturally you think? Because there's no series of seven in creation. We have 7 days in our calendar, but that's not sort of natural that you could see. So seven was already a common number, sevenfold for fullness, that everybody used. What else? Notice the division, that something needed to be divided. Okay, a little bit more. Okay, so you see that there were many gods and they ended up fighting with each other. And then over these wars and fights, eventually creation was formed. And so let's look at one other, the Enuma Elish. The Enuma Elish is a well-known Babylonian account. It's only one of the many. We have some others, but they're all sort of similar. So in this account, in the beginning, water was swirling in chaos. The waters divided into fresh water, which was one of the gods, Apsu, and salt water, the goddess Tiamat. The gods made it and bore many other gods. Most of the pagan accounts have to do with gods mating and producing offspring that ended up forming creation. Apsu did not like the young gods, so he decides to kill them. Tiamat, the mother of the gods, warns her son Ea, who kills Apsu while sleeping, but didn't tell Tiamat he was going to do it. Tiamat is infuriated, so she creates monsters to destroy her children. Lovely gods, huh? The war begins, but a god emerges, Marduk, who shoots an arrow into Tiamat and splits her in two. From her flow the waters of the Tigris and Euphrates. And out of her corpse, Marduk creates the universe and appoints gods to their various functions in the world. Then Marduk decides to create human beings from the remains of the other gods who fought with Tiamat. Ea creates the first man to help the gods maintain order. So Marduk became the creator god of the Babylonians. You may have heard the name Marduk before. And then the Egyptian sources, there's a number of different creation accounts, but this is one of them. There was a union between the first divine couple, and they brought forth a brother and sister pair, Jeb and Nut, who created Osiris. You've probably heard of Osiris, right? Isis, Seth, and Nephthys. Osiris and Isis, those are pretty well known. Some of them have a struggle for power, won by another god, and the world emerged from an infinite lifeless sea when the sun rose for the first time. So these are typical of the creation accounts that were already around that they would be familiar with, because they were raised in Egypt. And Moses especially, where did Moses go to school? The school of the Egyptians would have known and studied all these. Now, what all the creation accounts have in common, including Genesis, is they start with primeval, unorganized matter. Notice even in Genesis 1, the sea is there, but it needs to be overcome. Now, in the Babylonian account, the sea is a god, Tiamat, but obviously not in Genesis. You have the earth as a barren wasteland, which is common to all of them, the coming of light from chaos, the creation of the firmament, which obviously is in all of them, Genesis 2, the appearance of dry land, creation of the luminaries, the creation of man, and then we're going to look more at this next week. Creation becomes a temple of the God who ended up creating the world. So here's an example written from a Babylonian account. The holy house, the house of the gods, in the holy place had not yet been made. No reed had sprung up, no tree had been created, no brick had been laid, no building had been set up, no house had been erected, no city had been built, no city had been made, no creature had been created. So notice creation here is called a holy house for the gods. It's a temple. And that's going to be the theme of Genesis 1 also, creation as God's temple. So how do you explain the similarities? If you go to a university and you take ancient history, if the teacher, the professor is not a Christian or doesn't believe the Bible, they will try to explain that by saying Moses, there's so many similarities that Moses simply borrowed what was already out there, and then just took away the other gods and about the God of Israel. And so, because of the similarities, they assume the Hebrews borrowed the account. Moses simply stole, in a sense, what was already there. Sometimes Christians suggest, wanting to sort of fight against this view, that the pagans stole from Moses. And so Moses had written the first account, and then the others sort of took what Moses did, but then they obviously brought in all their fanciful stories of the gods and things. But because there were so many similarities, somebody borrowed. The problem with saying they borrowed from Moses is the timing is way off. It's very clear, we know from archaeology, et cetera, that these other accounts were first, before Moses. Which makes sense. The Egyptians had their own school that Moses was trained in when he was young, and they already had creation accounts available. Yes, Eric? Yeah, I'll talk about that. Right. Yeah, that's really leading to the third point, that there's a common origin, because this is actually what happened. It was passed down. And the common origin shares some similarities. And that really brings up the flood, what Eric just said. There was an account called the Gilgamesh Epic that was already out that had a flood story in there, Babylon's ancient history. And it's very similar to Genesis 6 through 9. And so the thought is Moses stole from the Gilgamesh Epic, because Gilgamesh was the Noah character in the flood. But the answer is that there was a flood, and it was in their own ancient history, and it orally carried on. So yes, you would expect the Babylonians to have some history of a flood that happened. So a common origin. And then four, what I'm suggesting to you is three and four are both correct. Four is Moses is using familiar patterns for polemical purposes. Something the Hebrews already were familiar with, but he's going to turn them around in a way to do polemics, to show where they're off. But he's going to take the same type of literary techniques they already used and the same emphasis, but then turn them. And that's what politics does. So let's look at that, the polemics of Genesis 1. You can open to Genesis 1 if you want. The obvious difference is this is the only account with not a bunch of gods, right? God alone, one God, creates all things. That would have stood apart, even though there's similarities in there's chaos over the world in the waters, they're split. In Moses' account, the inspired account, there's only one God, and he doesn't have to fight any other gods like all the other accounts. So this would have stood out polemically, not in a literary sense that, what is this? We don't even know what to do with this. It would have been something that they would have known what to do with. It sounded familiar. But thematic, what it's actually saying is so different from all the other accounts. There's no rival for God. There is one account where there's one creator God in one of the pagan stories, but even that God was formed. And so it's very clear in the beginning, there's God. He's not formed or made by anything or anyone. So this would have stood out. When God starts separating, there's no challenge to it. All the other accounts, the separation of the waters, the day and night, comes about from all kinds of battle, wars between the gods. And yet God in Genesis simply speaks. So when you hear, let there be light, you ever see the movie The Ten Commandments with Charlton Heston? Remember when Pharaoh always gave a decree? What did he always say? Let it be written, so let it be done. These are kingly fiats or decrees. And that's how Genesis 1 is written. It's God the King simply stating, let it be done. Let there be light. And so this comes across as one great king with no challengers. We're so used to that as Christians. We don't realize in those days that was a war. That was a battle that was very unique. No one had done that, to claim one God, uncreated, created all things with one word of his power. So whenever you see let there be light, think a king. That's the emphasis. Think a king's power. Day four is the most interesting as far as polemics. Because in day four, God creates the sun and the moon. And we talked about that last week, that this is a return to day one thematically to give us information how God separated the day and night. Well, he appointed the sun and moon to separate the day and light, it says. But what's interesting is sun and moon are not even named. What is it called in day four here? What are they called? Two great light, the greater light and lesser light. The words for sun and moon were readily available. As a matter of fact, they're throughout Genesis in Exodus and other contexts. Why at the beginning not just name them sun and moon? He created the sun, he created the moon. Okay, but to all the pagans, what were the sun and moon? Gods, yes. Oh, I see what you're saying, right? Yes, they're just objects, they're not gods. And so Luna, when we say the moon, was a god. And so Moses doesn't write, and God created Luna. He said, because that would give the impression that there's a lesser god, because that's what everyone, all the other nations believed. So Moses leaves those out and simply calls them the greater light and the lesser light. Now, is that ever used again in the Bible for sun and moon? No. From this point on, it will be sun and moon. And so those two, I even put them in the Hebrew word, Shemesh and Yirah. These were very common words that we would expect. And yet never again are they called greater and lesser lights. They're sun and moon. So Moses is doing polemics. He's saying, your God, the sun and the moon, are no gods at all. They're simply lights that God appointed, created and appointed. By the way, one of the problems when you think of stars, if the earth is only 10,000 years old, then stars cannot be millions of light years away. They would probably be burning us up to death. Because if the light takes that long to get here, the universe has to have been here a long, long time. Otherwise, you have God creating stars that aren't really stars and then moving them back, you know, millions of miles, which doesn't make a lot of sense. And then notice, and I brought this up once before, the pagans, when they looked at the sky, the stars were gods too, a lot of children gods. Notice how he says it then, verse 16, and God made the two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night, and the stars, almost like an afterthought. Oh yeah, and the stars too, no big deal. And so he names those, he calls those stars, but the sun and the moon, the main gods, he decides not to name. It's very clear that Moses is doing polemics. Moses, in a sense, is attacking all the pagan accounts with all their gods by leaving out these words that from the rest of the Genesis, Exodus, he'll bring in. So any thoughts on that? Is it something you've thought about before? When you read that, Genesis 1. Yes. Yes. So when we say that Genesis 1 is polemical, you all get that point now, right? You're looking at me like you're on something. Yes. 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 It would, yeah. Yes. Yeah, it's good to tell your children if they're going to go to a university, they're going to hear that Moses stole the Old Testament from what was already there. It's just a very common, and that's what Eric was referring to. It's just a common view. So you have to understand common origins. Any other thoughts? I mean, if you want to look at someone stealing, Joseph Smith, when he wrote the... there's a lot of stealing from the King James Bible. There. I'm almost word for word, pretty much, in sections. Right. Yes. So let's look at the second page, the back page. What was the message to Israel? This is polemics. What is Moses doing? Remember, he's writing to Israel, and they're about to enter the promised land, but it's Canaan, and it's filled with what? Canaanites, right? Pagans who worship all the different gods. And so the message of Genesis 1 to them would be the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God of Israel, the God who just led you out of Egypt through the Red Sea, he created all things by the word of his power. He is the only God. You see, even the Israelites were tempted to think, there are a lot of gods, and ours now is Yahweh. That nation has their God, we have Yahweh. And Moses is saying, there's only one God, and the creator God, that's Elohim, the Hebrew for creator God, Elohim, is Yahweh. That's how God revealed himself to Moses, as the one who redeems Israel, Yahweh. He's the same God. He's one God. That's what this would have emphasized. Also, man is not a God, and we'll get more into man in a few weeks. Man is not a God, but also not an animal. So some accounts, man is a God. Other times, man is looked on as no different than an animal. But man is certainly not God in Genesis 1, but he's certainly not an animal. He's the only creature made in God's image. And so that was different than all the other accounts. But more than anything else, number three, do not look to the pagan Canaanite gods for rain. God was leading them into a desert. And in the desert, if you don't have rain, you die. And so how did all the other pagans around them seek rain to happen? What did they do? They would make an offering to their gods. If you were up north, it was Baal. Baal was the rain god. And so they would actually reenact some of the sexual proclivities that happened at creation in their accounts. That's why they were so horrible. And they would try to reenact it so God would rain down their gods. And were the Israelites tempted when there was no rain to go to those worship sites? All throughout the Old Testament, right? And where were those sites be? What are they called in the Old Testament? Don't go to the high places, because they understood hills. Remember, mountains always represent heaven. They would go to the highest place and reenact their little festival and offer their offerings. And so notice Deuteronomy 4:19. And when you look up to the sky and see the sun, moon, and stars, here you have the normal names, all the heavenly array, do not be enticed into bowing down to them and worshiping things the Lord your God has apportioned to all the nations under heaven. You'll be very tempted to worship all the other gods, whether for rain or anything else, but mostly rain, because again, rain was life. They were agriculture community. And so they were always tempted, and often did, look to the pagan gods for rain, to have food. And so Genesis 1 would have been a polemic. Those gods don't exist. The sun, moon, and stars, I appointed. There's only one God. That's what would stood out to them. Let me read some quotes. I don't always recommend Peter Enns. He can be problematic in other ways, but in some of these situations, he has some really good points. Genesis 1 is a bold declaration that the God of a tiny nation with a troubled past is the one responsible for what you see. The gods of the superpowers didn't do it. Yahweh did. In the ancient world, those are fighting words. Didn't you just ask me that? And so think about how that would have looked. They all had their creation accounts. They were great myths. And then Moses writes, the God of our little tiny nation of poor people, pretty much, is the God, the one God of the universe that made all things. We're so used to reading Genesis 1 and thinking that, we don't even think in that world what that was saying. Maybe one day when there's more views of many gods in our country, this will be more challenging, but we're very used to it. Another one. Yahweh often does in history the actions claimed by the other gods in the mythologies of Israel's neighbors. Remember how dividing the chaos, the waters, that kind of language was already there? This process known as demythologizing occurs in the Genesis creation accounts. The first creation story in Genesis demythologizes the cosmology of Egypt. The four conditions present at the beginning of creation in Genesis parallel those represented, and this is a Egyptian account. However, rather than the elements of the creation having a volition of their own, the text portrays them as inanimate objects which move according to the direction of Yahweh's word. Drew, your point about only objects, right? And then I couldn't find the author of this, but it's a good summary. The standard model of creation in the ancient Near East is sexual procreation. Pre-existing primordial water is the first gods, and through procreation, new generations of gods are produced, bringing greater differentiation in the material. Land, sky, air, rivers, all those were gods, lesser gods, with each succeeding generation. Strikingly, the ex nihilo creation, that's out of nothing, of the material world by a transcendent, immaterial, pre-existing god is unique to the Bible and has no parallel in the ancient Near East. Even the Egyptian god Ptah, who offers the closest parallel when he creates the other gods by thought and speech, is himself created from primordial water. So in one sense, it's written somewhat like the accounts, but it's so unique in its polemics of what it presents that it would have been the only account to stand out as entirely different than all the others. I hope that gives a more expanded, helpful way to look at why it's in the Bible than trying to argue over science when that's not the point. The point is not the age of the earth, that they're not interested, Moses is not interested in that question. He's writing for Israel, and he's writing as a polemic against all the other nations so they know who their God is, and they're not tempted to the other gods. Thoughts? Questions? Yes, Millie. And that's a great point. That happens to a lot of young people who grew up in the church. They, for the first time, see the similarities. They don't know what to do with it. Yeah, and so when a professor would say Moses had to borrow it because these things were so similar, we would say partially that's true. That because we always borrow language that people understand. But what he did was so unique and different that that's what you're not giving credit to. That no account is like Genesis 1 in what it actually says about God. Yes. Yeah, that's as far back. I mean, that was the ancient world. There was maybe other things going on. But we don't have, right. Yes. Yeah. And now we have more ability to go back and find those. Right. Yes, Jonathan. Any other thoughts? So next week we'll look at one more sort of theme that's in Genesis 1. The way Moses is writing is it's a temple text. There's temple building going on, and now we'll look at more the Sabbath day as the fulfillment. All right, are we done? All right. Oh, yes, go ahead. Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And we see that, how often they are told to give up their gods. So they still had the little statues of other gods in their homes just in case. You know, in other ways. Yeah, if God A doesn't come through, I still have God B. Yeah. Right. And that's a real good point, what you said, Raquel, before that. The polemic is not just against the nations, it's for Israel. It's for them not to be tempted. That's what Moses is doing, right? All right. Well, let's pray. Oh, yeah, David, sorry. Yeah. You've got to, I was talking to an atheist last week, even in my family, and they raised that point. They said, well, if you believe there's a God, then someone had to create him if cause and effect is always true. And I said, well, you have a bigger problem. If there's no God, matter is eternal. So you explain to me how matter can always exist. Eternally back, matter. And he says, yeah, I don't know. So we all have things that are beyond what we can fathom. We can't fathom eternity. But saying there's no God doesn't solve your problem of trying to fathom something that doesn't make sense. It's beyond us either way. All right, let's pray.